Well, greetings once again to all of Turdville. It is Thursday. This Thursday is actually the 10th of July, and it is time for another Access to Access presentation. Today's guest is someone new to Turdville. He's an author. He is a fund manager out of the Netherlands, and his name is Willem Middelkoop. Now, I've gotten to know Willem a little bit. We have a mutual friend in Coos, is that right? I guess, Willem, right?
Yeah, Coos Janssen, he's a great Dutch friend, and he has been doing some great reporting on China and gold, and you really have to follow this guy.
Absolutely. Yeah, what's neat about him is, if I remember his story right, he had he went on disability or something for an illness, or and kind of got into studying gold, and then has made himself into a globally known and renowned expert on Chinese demand. And it's a great story. But Will, your own personal story, just for everybody that isn't familiar with you, you have been a money manager and an author now for quite some time. You first wrote a book. It came out in August of 2007. I'm not even going to try to pronounce the Dutch title, but in English, it's something like When the Dollar Collapses, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Now that book kind of made you a bit of a celebrity in the Netherlands. You've sold 50,000 copies. It's on its 17th edition. And you talked then about the coming economic crisis that then came out. And, you know, obviously everybody remembers in 2008. You've turned that into you run a hedge fund, if you will, based in the Netherlands. It's called the Commodity Discovery Fund, which is hard assets and miners primarily, correct?
Yeah, mainly gold and silver, 75%.
There you go. And I'll have you talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But your latest book, I think, is fantastic. It's called The Big Reset, with the subtitle War on Gold and the Financial Endgame. You know, we're always looking for things that we can give to our brother-in-law, or our neighbor, or our coworker, or somebody, say, God, you got to wake up. And those people are out there, but you know, we have to help them as much as we can. And when I read your book, Willem, I thought this is a great book. And so I encourage everybody, there's a link here on this podcast page. I encourage everybody to buy a copy, read it just for your own personal background, then give it to somebody, you know, buy two copies, keep one for yourself and give one away. So anyway, that's why I wanted to bring Willem in. Willem, it's a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much for coming in. I want to kind of dive right into it and talk about, let's start with your fund, how you run it, who is it open to, and what do you see in the gold and silver markets going forward from here?
I've been a journalist for 20 years, between 1980 and 2005, but I also was a private investor. I started in real estate in Amsterdam in the 90s, made some money, and then I took some profits between 2001 and 2004, and then I started to invest into gold and silver mining companies, mainly Canadian companies, during that time. And then I learned that the largest gains were made by companies, smaller companies doing new discoveries. So I really specialized on that one. I had a newsletter, the Gold Discovery Letter at that time, and that we turned into a fund, the Commodity Discovery Fund. We started in July 08. I quit as a journalist, as a market commentator for Dutch national TV in 2008, and really started to concentrate on the fund management. So we only have some 600 high net worth investors, mainly Dutch investors. We have some $50 million dollars assets under management at this moment. We're open for international investors, not for American investors, but we're open for Canadian investors or other European investors. And we specialize in still in discovery plays in the resource sector. We have a portfolio which consists of some 50, 60 resource companies. 50% is gold related, 25% is silver related, and the other 25% is in the rare earth elements, or it can be copper, can be zinc, can be diamonds, some special place.
Sure. How do you feel about price at this point, Willem? I mean, you and I both recognized a double bottom back at the end of last year, and now we're after kind of a kind of a fall back in the spring of this year. We're moving forward again. The miners, if you look at the HOOPE or some of the other indices, are they're perking up as well. You feeling pretty good right now?
Yeah, we've been privileged with our loyal base of investors. It has been hard in the last 2 or 3 years, but almost all of them, they stayed with us. But we did a huge amount of communication and webinars to inform them on the long-term horizon of this very strong bull market, which is still at play, in my opinion. And especially last 12 to 14 months, we did an awful lot of reporting showing them the bottom was in. There was a double bottom in December at 1180. We had a confirmation of the bottom at 1280 early June. And fortunately, we had some inflow of money in the last 12 months, around 13 million American dollars. So we bought a huge amount of shares at rock bottom prices. So now, currently this year, year to date, we are up 40%, 4-0. So we're doing well. And I think we're witnessing the first stages of a very interesting new bull market developing in our sphere.
Certainly feels that way on this end as well. As we transition into your book, you know, I know you're a fan of the site and come by quite a bit and check out what we're talking about it in TF Metals Report. You know, the subtitle has always been, since I started it 4 years ago, that we are approaching the end of the great Keynesian experiment. I think that kind of ties in. It's probably about what you're talking about when you talk about the big reset. I mean, to you, what is, I mean, that's the title of your book. What is the big reset?
Yeah, we could be brothers, Greg, actually. We live on another side of the planet. We think alike. I've been a student of monetary history since 1996, 1997. And when you study monetary history, you learn that financial crisis and monetary crisis are not very rare. Actually, these kind of crises have happened dozens of times, and you can learn a great deal by studying former crises. And in the end of my book, I think you've seen it, is a list of all the failed, unbacked money systems. So
yes.
When money is not backed by something tangible like gold and silver, they always fail. So one thing you know for sure, if a money system is unbacked by something tangible, it's a fiat money system, it always will fail. So it's only a question when will it fail. And I always had worries on my mind about the current dollar system, and that's why I wrote the book in 2006, 2007. I wrote the book, my first book, When the Dollar Falls or Collapses. And in this book, I predicted that I said it's not a question if a financial crisis will occur, but only when. And I expected it within 10 to 15 years. That was 2007, but it all occurred within 12 months. So that made me real famous in the Netherlands. But then, because I was studying the financial system since 1997, 1998, I always been thinking about what the next stages would be.
Mm-hmm.
And people often make the mistake that they think this financial system is binary, you know, it works or it fails. So people always think about a total collapse. But when you know that central bankers have almost unlimited power to change the system, it's better to think about the system not as a binary system, which only will have two colors, black or white, but this is a system in which you don't have black and white, but you can have grayscales, 256 types of grayscale. And at a certain point, you reach this system reaches a point that there has to be a reset, that has to be restructured. That's one of the first problems. There has to be a global debt restructuring, especially in developing economies. And the second problem is that we have the dollar now as an anchor for the financial system, and it's very obvious that this can't go on for a very long time. and especially Russia and China, they're very vocal about their wish to end this part of the system. So they want a new anchor for the financial system. So these are my main points. We reach the end of this great Keynesian experiment, and we have to get rid of excess debt, and we do need to find a new anchor for the financial system.
And that's exactly right. I do find, I'm glad you mentioned that section of your book. I would, for everybody listening, when you get a copy of the book, you'll find this is fascinating. I can't imagine how long it took for you to come up with this list, but there are 24 pages of single space type of currencies from the last 4 or 5 centuries that have ultimately failed or been replaced. It's remarkable to page through things you've never in a million years heard of. The Belgian Belga from 25 to 1945, that kind of stuff. It's a remarkable bit of research that you've done there. I want to take, you mentioned something I did want to ask you about. You know, as part of this reset, it comes up from time to time. I've even seen members of Congress, I think even Ron Paul talked about this, this idea of a debt cancellation, that the debt held by central banks, and, you know, in this case, the Federal Reserve balance sheet is up to $4 trillion, at least what they show, that this idea that they could just cancel it, just say, you know, you don't have to pay us back. And there is, as you mentioned in the book, there is within Judeo-Christian tradition this idea of the year of Jubilee, you know, whether
it's debt cancellation.
Yeah, which is a debt cancellation. So, I mean, it's not as if it would, there is not a history or a tradition of this type of thing in Western society. So, let me just put it this way. What was bad about that idea? I mean, I've got my own ideas, but this is not really in my realm of expertise. I mean, what do you think of this idea? Is it something they're going to try, and how would it work, and what would be the impacts?
Debt cancellations have always been there. You know, if you read the Bible, they're mentioned there. So debt restructurings, debt cancellations have always been part of the system. And I think a country like France and Greece and almost all countries, they had their debt restructurings in the past. There's only one country which never had a debt restructuring, and that's Switzerland. So debt restructurings are part of monetary cycles, you could say, and monetary resets. And there was a very interesting study published on Christmas Eve by the IMF. And why on Christmas Eve? Because on Christmas Eve, all journalists are at home, they're on holiday. So, you know, when you want to publish a study, but you don't want to get a lot of attention, press attention, you publish it on Christmas Eve or Friday nights. But Christmas Eve is even better. And on Christmas Eve, 2013, the IMF published a study written by the economist Reinhardt and Rogoff. You might remember those names because they also wrote this wonderful book, This Time is Different, which is a study of a few centuries of financial crisis. So that's a wonderful book, but in this IMF working paper, 266, it has a title, Financial and Sovereign Debt Crisis, Some Lessons Learned and Those Forgotten. I think we can send you the link.
Yes.
So all your subscribers can get it. And it's a very simple study, actually. It's only 24 pages or something like that. And it has some real good recommendations. And the authors, they start by informing the audience that, well, financial crises have been, they're quite normal. They happen at least once in a generation. And they also say that, unfortunately, politicians in the developed countries, they can't inform the public that there is a need to restructure debt. So they keep the fact that debts have to be restructured and debts have to be canceled. They keep this fact hidden from the public. But in this report, they give all kinds of examples of former financial crisis and former banking crisis, and they clearly show that debt restrictions have always been part of the process of solving the problems after a banking or after a credit crisis. So it's, again, it's not a question if we get a debt restructuring, it's only a question when we'll get the debt restructuring.
Is that then, and this is what I can't get my arms around, I mean, how inflationary is that? Because the money has been issued, and the idea of it not being permanently a part of the global or the U.S. or whatever country, you know, whatever country was doing this economy, is the fact that eventually it might have to be repaid. If it never has to be repaid, isn't that just terribly inflationary to do that kind of thing? That's what I mean.
Well, most important thing to understand about the debt restrictions, this is very harmful for pensioners.
Sure.
And savers. And pensioners, if you look at an average pension fund, their bond portfolio, you know, that's the main part of their portfolio, because these bonds, they are always called safe. And currently, the total mountain of all bonds outstanding, all treasuries outstanding, it's $100 trillion.
Right.
And the whole financial world thinks this will all be repaid one day, but it's one big Ponzi scheme, you know, these debts are rolled over, but at a certain point, we need to cancel 10, 20, 30% of this debt. And I think the biggest pain will be felt by investors in these kind of bonds, and those are typically the pension funds, the insurer companies. But I'm a little afraid that our problems are so large and our system has grown so big that we could reach the end of this experiment, as you might call it, and that we need a much bigger reset than just a debt restructuring. So if we study this IMF report by Rogoff and Reinhardt, we know we need a debt restructuring within a few years, but I'm afraid that this won't be enough, and it might be needed to come up with a whole new system,
yeah,
in which we also get a new anchor for the financial system, which could be the SDR of the IMF. And I think one interesting story, if you allow me to mention it. I was at a dinner in London a few months ago, because I've become a member of the advisory board of the OMFIF. The OMFIF is a monetary think tank, which was started by a few former journalists of the Financial Times. And we had a dinner, and it was a very small group, I think about around 13 or 14 of us. And the guest of honor was the highest ranking Chinese IMF director. And there are only six or seven IMF directors at that level. They report to Christine Lagarde. And we've been talking about all kinds of facts of the financial system. And he was very open. And, you know, this is off the record discussion, so you can't quote him. But at the end of the dinner, I asked him one question, because I thought we were all too positive that night about the financial system. And I asked him, couldn't it be true that we need a debt restructuring at some point? And then he was quiet for a few seconds, and then he said, this is too sensitive to talk about.
Hmm.
And by saying that, he gave the best answer I could get.
Yeah.
Because that answer told me the IMF is looking into this, the IMF is studying this, and nothing can be said about this because it's simply too sensitive. And I understand why it is too sensitive.
Yeah.
Because if an IMF director is talking about this openly, and this would be published, you know, it can start a panic.
You mentioned, Willem, this idea of an SDR coming from the IMF, but and that's certainly something a lot of people mention. And another thing that we are always talking about too is the emergence of regional, if you will, at least reserve currencies. One being a maybe a gold-backed yuan or a gold-backed ruble, or some combination thereof. Do you see that as a possibility? What I guess is your favorite possibility of what succeeds the dollar system?
There are a few scenarios which you can imagine now. My most favorite scenario, they're all bad, but the least bad, my favorite, that's the scenario I write about in my book, and that's a scenario in which all countries worldwide cooperate to bring this financial system to a new phase under the direction of the IMF, with support of China and even Russia. If we can't have a worldwide agreement on a new financial system, we might have a system which falls apart, and then you will have the introduction of maybe regional currency cooperation and regional currency systems. But I doubt that. Why? China, I think, is the most important player in this respect. China has huge financial reserves, as you know. China and the US are so interlinked, they can't live without each other. It's like a bad marriage, you know. They know they can't split because they would be worse off. So they accept a bad marriage situation. And China was given access to the top level in the IMF. As I told you, there's a Chinese guy. He's one of the directors. So the Chinese are incorporated within the IMF. And the IMF, of course, is a US-centered organization. And I think the US understand that they have to give up the dollar as the world reserve currency at some point. Of course, they want to wait as long as possible. But when they have to give up the dollar as the only world reserve currency, they might be interested in proposing to use the special drawing rights of the IMF because the dollar is still a huge part of this SDR. I think it's 40%, 40. So by introducing the SDR as the new world reserve currency, they are still in the driver's seat, the US and the IMF. And I think the Chinese, they are willing to support this new phase of the financial system and this new idea of bringing forward the SDR, because the Chinese, they want, they're scared. I think one of the things China is most scared about, that's chaos, monetary chaos. And why are they so scared for monetary chaos? Because the communists, they took power after the Second World War because of the monetary chaos in China at that time. The communists only could take power because there was a hyperinflationary situation, and there was so much chaos that they took over, and well, they built the China as we know now. So the Chinese, they know they have to avoid monetary chaos. So by working together with the United States and with the IMF, I think that's their most important bet to avoid monetary chaos.
That makes a lot of sense, Willem.
Yes.
As you mentioned.
And I think even Russia and Putin, of course, Putin hates the US because the US was responsible for the collapse of the former Soviet Union. Reagan, President Reagan, and Margaret Thatcher, they worked together in the 80s by bringing down commodity prices and oil prices. They knew they could bring Russia on its knees by decreasing the amount of money Russia was making on their production of oil and commodities, and by increasing the cost of their defense operators by starting this this buildup of weapons. So that's the way the former Soviet Union was built, brought on his knees, and Putin is still mad about this. He was a young spy at that time, and Putin, he would like to see the US collapse. But I think Putin is not that important, and when China is a much more important player in this respect, and I think China and Russia, they also need each other. So China will make Putin cooperate with this plan. I think that's my personal opinion.
I think it's logical the way you've laid that out too, Willem. And you know, we talk a lot about China and their gold demand and what their ultimate plans are. But like you said, working within the current system first is certainly logical. As I move to the
Greg, if I may add one point, because
please,
this
go ahead.
This is so important in my view. The best evidence of the US and China working together can be found in the sale of the JP Morgan Chase Manhattan Plaza building in Wall Street. I don't know if you know the story.
Yes, yeah, most folks here do, yeah.
Okay, so the most important office building owned by JP Morgan, it's directly opposite the Federal Reserve New York building.
Yep.
It was sold to the Chinese. The official story in the press was that this was just a real estate investment by the Chinese. But we all know that investments at this level in the heart of Wall Street, they can't be done without the approval of the White House. They can't be done without the approval of the Chinese leaders.
Right.
And if you know that this building has the largest private gold vaults, and which are directly connected with the Federal Reserve gold vault.
Yes, it is.
You know it's about the gold vaults. It's not about the office space on the 30 levels above the ground level. It's about this the gold vaults. So this tells me it must be part of a broader agreement between the Chinese and the US about the buildup of gold stocks, gold reserves by the Chinese. And I'm quite sure, because the Chinese, they always bought a lot of treasuries, 300-400 billion a year, but they stopped in 2009, 2010. They stopped buying US treasuries.
Yes.
And I'm quite sure at that time they informed the US, the Federal Reserve, that the strategy of the Federal Reserve to lower the value of the dollar was very harmful for China, that this had to be stopped. And this was post-crisis, so the Federal Reserve started with QE, which was lowering the value of the dollars. And I'm quite sure that the Chinese, they demanded a hedge on the falling dollar, on the decreasing value of the dollar. So the only hedge you can imagine is they want to increase their gold position. And when did the Chinese start to buy up all this gold? They started in 2010, 2011. So I think part of the deal between the US and the Chinese is that the Chinese said, we stop buying treasuries. You make sure we can get enough gold. If you can bring the gold price lower, you know, we will help you on that because that's very fortunate for us. Then we can buy more gold. So that explains the manipulation of the gold price lower in the last few years. And we've seen the gold imports of China rising. Every month the gold price was falling. And I think part of this broader understanding was that the Chinese, that the US said to the Chinese, okay, you can import 2,000 tons of gold a year or 1,500 tons yearly, but if you want some extra gold, it has to stay in the US. And then the Chinese, they must have said, well, it can stay in the US, but then we want the keys of the vaults. We don't mm-hmm. want to end up in the German situation or the Dutch uh-huh. situation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think then the US proposed that they could buy the JP Morgan building. We put the gold in the vaults there. You can check it yourself. You have the key to the vaults. and it's not in the Federal Reserve gold vault anymore. So this is the only logical explanation for this JP Morgan transaction.
Well, and that fits right in with, you know, I've often chronicled here the exact perfect 1, 2, 3 metric tons additions that have come into the JP Morgan COMEX vault.
Yeah, right, right, because they want 1,000 kilos at a time.
Yeah, yeah, and there'd be the only explanation for that is that they're a perfect,
yeah.
Either it's a joke, it's fake, and it's, you know, just a paper transaction, or they are perfect brand new kilo bars,
yeah.
Straight from Asia. It makes a lot of sense. Makes a lot of sense.
Greg, now we continue because it gets more exciting. When the U.S. agreed to hand over large gold reserves to the Chinese, of course they paid for it. The Chinese, I think, had to agree that the U.S. or the IMF, I better say, that the IMF could use these gold reserves, also the Chinese gold reserve, to back up the SDR when needed,
mm-hmm.
to convince the world that the SDR would be a great successor of
yeah.
the dollar as the world reserve currency, because it would be partially gold backed by the gold of the US, which we can't check if it's there in Fort Knox, but we have to presume it's there because we can't check it. So the US can convince us it's there. We have 8,000 tons the US gold reserve, then we have some 9,000 tons European gold reserves in total, and China will have gold reserves to the amount of 5,000-6,000 tons. We don't know yet, that's still secret, but we know they're building it. So when you combine these gold reserves of the US, the EU and China, you have this wonderful load of gold, almost 20,000 tons, and that could be a wonderful foundation for the new SDR as the new world reserve currency, which would not be fully gold-backed, and I don't expect to go
right.
back on a gold standard,
right.
but, you know, we can convince the public it's there and it's valuable.
That kind of dovetails into, I've got two questions in queue. From listeners that kind of dovetail exactly into that, Willem. So
yeah.
Let me ask you. One comes from John, who wants to know that. I mean, he calls it what we talk about, a Eurasian alliance, but as it fits into what you just described of these creditor nations like China or Russia working with the IMF and in a sense the U.S. and going off in that new direction. Will that finally allow the precious metals prices to rise to a more natural supply-demand equilibrium, something?
Yeah. No, these are very important questions for investors. We have them in our fund. And I think we have two possible scenarios. One is as more and more people are starting to realize what China's gold plan is, as we discuss it now, and as Coach Janssen has so wonderful described it and published it in the last few months and the last year, as more and more people understand the Chinese gold plan, they will start to add gold to their personal investment.
Right.
Because if China thinks this is the best hedge for the problems in the financial system, if Russia is adding gold, it might be interesting for individuals or pension funds. So this will help, this understanding will help to bring gold back towards $2,000, $1,900, $2,000, where we also have been 3 years ago. But I think a much more interesting scenario which might occur is that central bankers, and now we get to the debt restructuring, central bankers, the IMF, could propose during a big reset to revalue gold and to devalue money, the currency, the dollar.
Right.
And it's very easy and it's very beneficial to the US to propose a gold revaluation because the U.S. gold reserves are still valued at $42 an ounce, the historical cost price, while the European gold reserves are valued mark to market. And why is this so important? If you look at the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve and the Treasury, you see a double counting of the $8,000 tons of gold reserves. You can find them on the Treasury, and you can find them on the Federal Reserve balance sheet. And if you revalue gold towards $4,200, the $11 billion, which is on the balance sheet now, becomes $1.1 trillion. You can follow me?
Yeah.
So at the current Federal Reserve balance sheet, you only can find a value for the U.S. gold reserves, and that amount is $11 billion. If you revalue the price of gold to $4,200, this will become $1,100 billion. So the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve and the Treasury will be helped by a revaluation of gold. And in the same operation, the Federal Reserve and the Treasury could write off the $2 trillion of U.S. Treasuries, which you also can find on the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve, because the Federal Reserve, the Treasury owes the Federal Reserve $2,000 billion for the Treasuries, which are on the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve. So a debt restructuring and a revaluation of gold can solve the problems on the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, that's true. That's an very interesting point. I hadn't really thought of it that way, and that is logical as well. One more question from subscribers. You're being very generous again with your time, and so I wanted to give you one more question from subscribers. This has to do then with silver. Historically, silver has played an even bigger role monetarily than gold. It hasn't, though, now for quite some time. There's Robert wants to know if even though it would seem logical that silver would be monetized again, in driving the price higher, that might have a very negative impact on all of its productive uses. You know, it's in so much use in technology, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So anyway, this is kind of a drawn out question, but in the end, what do you see as a role for silver after the big reset?
Well, most important point in that respect is the gold-silver ratio. Historical, this ratio has always been 1 in 15, and now it's 1 in 65.
Yeah.
So silver will follow gold. I don't expect silver to be again introduced as a component of a new phase of the monetary system. I expect silver still to be used in the industry. You know, 60% of physical silver is used in the industry.
Yeah.
We had huge above the ground silver stocks in the last 20, 30 years, you know, a few billion ounces of silver, old silver coins. They were all available, but almost all are gone. I expect silver shortages quite soon. Within 12 to 18 months, we can have real silver shortages, like we can have platinum and palladium shortages. But if gold will be revalued, as I expect that central bankers will do at a certain point, because if you revalue gold to $4,000, you know, it helps the American balance sheet wonderful, as I explained, but also gold will become too expensive for the general public. So if you fix the gold price at $4,200, gold as a private investment isn't very interesting anymore, but silver will do a lot. Well, silver will follow gold in the ratio we have described. So I see a lot of upside for silver. And actually, in our fund, we're very overweight silver. 25% of our holdings is silver related. So I expect silver to move towards $50, $70, $100 within a few years. And silver can go way north of $100 an ounce.
I absolutely. I agree. And that just makes logical sense as well. In that, they're always been tied at the hip, and that ratio is called a historical ratio just because it goes back so far in history.
Okay,
We're
yeah.
not, even though we've stretched it, as you said, to 65-1, it's not going to be stretched to 650 or 6,000.
No. And actually, there are analysts who say silver is so important for the industry, you even could get a ratio of 1 to 5 or 1 to 1.
Wow. Yeah.
And if people ask me, Willem, what's my safest bet for my money? And I only have a few thousand left, I always say buy physical silver.
Yeah.
Because the upside is at least 100%, but possibly 1,000%. And if you have physical silver, what's the risk you have? That is stolen. That's the only risk.
Yeah. Yeah. And to own a lot of it takes up a lot of space. But other than that,
Yeah, but if you only own a few thousand, for the rich, silver is too cheap. But I always compare it. It's the same problem when you say, "Well, I can't buy enough Rembrandts or Van Goghs." What's the problem that you get too many kilos of silver? Well, find the haystack for it.
exactly. And let me, one last question came in, and this is, you can answer this, I guess, probably reasonably quickly, but I don't want to put you too much on the spot. But I mean, if you had to pick, it's been very challenging. They've extended, one of my favorite things that I say is the ability of the powers that be to cling to power is a lot stronger than I would have thought in 2009. The question from Scott is, I mean, if you had to put a guess, when do you see the big reset finally happening? Is it something in the next year or two? Is it, I mean,
No,
have a feel?
no, no, because changes in this system take much longer than you always expect.
Right.
The only big reset which could occur on a short notice if we get a real big crash, larger than the one we had in 2008, within 12 months. But this can't happen because in 2008, the crash, the financial crisis, came unexpectedly. So I always say during presentations, the fire brigade was still in the barracks. And now, after the crash in 2008 and 2009, there's a quick response team brought out worldwide. So every crisis we now can cope with because we just start to print more money and open the floods of money again. So every crisis, central bankers can fight any crisis now, and they will hold on to power, like you said. So politicians and central bankers will work together to hold on to power, and I think they want to propose a new system when they see the time has run out to buy any more time. So when they need to bring a new face of this system.
And again, their hand might be forced by external events that, dominoes tipping into each other. But in the meantime, they're going to take their time and do it when it's most advantageous to them.
Yeah, but Greg, if the Federal Reserve can print as much money as they like, they can solve any crisis. The same happens in China. When China has a big crisis, financial crisis, the Chinese Central Bank can print as much money by all assets they want to add to their balance sheet. So I can't imagine a crisis, or it should be World War III, in which the problems can't be solved by just printing more money and putting the losses on the balance sheets of the central banks.
Eventually, that gets
So,
to be so large, though, that they have to act.
yeah, at one point, the balance sheet of central banks, they become too large, and then you need a debt restructuring, and then you better do this in a big reset. And I expect this to occur not before 2020, but maybe 2020, 2022, 2023, because at a certain point, you reach a limit. Look at Japan. Japan is expanding their money base. at a very aggressive rate, and at some point the Japanese have to restructure their debt, because we talk about China, we talk about the US, but Japan, I think, will need it first.
Makes sense to me. Well,
so Japan will also be interested to support a global reset initiated by the IMF.
And like you said, they'll all kind of fall in line and try to work together in the end, most likely.
Even Russia, because Russia needs the EU and needs China to sell their energy.
Yes.
Because if they can't sell their energy, you know, they're broke. So yeah. even Putin, and he's a smart fox. Putin is not a madman. Eh? Putin is no Hitler. So he's a smart guy. So he knows he has to buy time. Every day he receives 1 billion of the sales of oil and gas. So Putin needs the world to function well. So we need his oil and gas, and he needs high oil prices. So Putin doesn't want a big crisis either.
Sounds right. Well, Will, thank you. I really appreciate all your time. We have a kind of a tradition here before I let you go of what I call the final four, which are just kind of just four quick questions. You know, you usually yeah. answer them in a word or two or maybe a sentence, just to let everybody kind of get a little better understanding, get to know you a little bit better. So it is now almost 5 o'clock there in the Netherlands. So it's time, like I said, for a happy hour. So if you were to go out get yourself a pint of something, would you also order some bitterballen? Are you a fan of that?
The bitterballen, that's a wonderful part of Dutch culture, and they're best, you know, together with a drink around 5, 6 p.m., and they're wonderful.
So you're a big fan of bitterballen?
Yeah, I love them,
Fair enough.
Everybody does.
Now, how about a little Dutch history? Famous for windmills. Now, I pulled this number off the internet. About how many windmills are there in the Netherlands? You got a guess?
Oh, I think still at least a few hundred, but I wouldn't be surprised when it's over 500. I see them every day. They're just normal part of the landscape here, and some of them are still working.
The number I got was almost 1,200, so they are still out there.
I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised.
some would say that what I do every day is quixotic. So maybe I ought to come over there and start poking at them. Have you ever cooked anything in a Dutch oven?
Some cookies only.
See, we have a thing here in the U.S. It's like a big pot with a lid on it, and they call it a Dutch oven. I just didn't know if that actually came from.
Okay. No, I don't know that one.
Okay. And lastly, you sound like you recovered okay from the disappointment of yesterday.
Oh, yeah. We had a wonderful, exciting evening. I have two sons, 10 and 13, and they stayed up real late because the game was finished at 1 a.m. And they both have holidays now, and I just phoned home and I learned that my youngest son of 10, he had slept until 1 p.m. because he was so tired.
Very emotional day for him.
He was exhausted.
Come Sunday, who's gonna win the cup, the Germans or the Argentines?
I hope the Argentines, but I'm sure the Germans will win.
Well, they look tough, don't they? Whoa.
Yeah.
Willem, thank you very much. Again, the book is The Big Reset, a link here on the podcast page. I encourage you to check it out. And if you are a global investor, not from the U.S., but anyplace else, please check out. I'll give you a link to Willem's site and check out his Commodity Discovery Fund as well. Willem, thank you very much. I hope you enjoy your holiday, and I hope you become a regular around Turdville and that we can visit again sometime soon.
Oh, wonderful. Thanks for the invitation. Sorry for my English. I will work on it.
Oh, my.
I hope to come back.
Let me put it this way. Your English is about a million times better than my Dutch. So no need to apologize.
Okay. Thanks for having me. Wonderful to talk to you. Feels like brothers.
You got it, my friend. Have a great holiday, and we'll speak again soon.
Thanks.